is Harrison against Deer and Company. Mr. Doak.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors. This case is a de novo review of a race judicata claim. And by the way, my name is John Doak, and I thank you for recognizing that. I was not the attorney on the brief or the other portions of this case, but I do have a lot to add based upon the synthesis of the briefs. And I think that oral argument in this case is critical to hone in and synthesize what the issues really are here.
But could I just stop you? Because every one of these cases seems to have arisen from his termination, no matter what the reason for the termination might have been. He could have claimed race discrimination in either of the two state court suits. And what I've been wondering is, why isn't that the end of the matter?
Oh, I think that's a very important point that needs to be addressed. When we're looking at this and from a race judicata perspective, there's two things that are critical. There's the identity of the action, which is the facts, the things that you're talking about, and the identity of the parties. I will submit to you right now and admit the identity of the action is our weakest argument. In order to get around that, we have to say, well, race discrimination goes back from 2000 or 2002, 2004, up through the investigation, and then all of a sudden now the decision's made on September 3rd, and that's the critical factor. The other issues really are in that investigatory stage up to the point of discrimination. I think there's a window there. I think it's our weak argument. The strong argument we have is on the identity of the parties, and that is critical for any...
Does that get you anywhere? The second case, unlike the first is against individual managers, the second case is against Deere. The state judiciary in Illinois dismissed the second case on account of preclusion, race judicata. That tells us the second case has already established that the difference in the identity of the parties doesn't avoid
the
preclusion.
Second case has not gone to the appellate court yet. The second state case is still pending. The only case that has gone to the appellate...
What we know is from the state judiciary, they think... Those state judges who have spoken so far, they think that you can't avoid the preclusive effect of the first case by suing Deere rather than the managers in the second case.
Right. The state trial court issue with regard to the Section 9 of the Personnel Record Review Act did find that. And I would submit to you they were wrong. And that's what I'm going to spend my time telling you why they were wrong. Because when you have a state court case, which we did in the first case for slander and for intentional interference with tort, the gravamen of that case is they are acting outside of their relationship with Deere. We can't plead it. We can't get to first base without the allegation they're acting outside of their relationship. And privity is the relationship. We could not sue Deere for those issues. We couldn't sue Deere for slander, because we would have to go outside of the termination. We couldn't sue them for intentional interference with their contract because they're a party to the contract. And under the law, you have a privilege to interfere with your own contract. So we're solely focused in that first case on those managers for their actions outside of their relationship with Deere. This is a case where we're saying, hey, this is Deere stuff that Deere did. Deere could not have been sued for those other actions. There may have been identity of some of the causes of act or the facts, but not the parties. Because what you're essentially saying, if you adopt that agreement, is we're not going to look at what the legal pleadings are. We're not going to look at what the parties' relationships are. We're going to say, what was the end result in the case? And if we lost Addington, that means that Deere was a party in interest in a case that they could not have been sued under. They couldn't have been sued under those theories. That's why it's critical. Our position is, and this is the nuance of the case, that when you look at race judicata for the identity of parties, You have to look at the pleadings. Was Deere's managers, were Deere's managers pled in a relationship with Deere? Absolutely not. We had to plead that they were acting solely outside of their relationship with Deere. Without that, we don't get to first base. So when you look at, well, could Deere have been a party at that? No, they couldn't have. And the minute we say Deere was a...
Why not?
Because the minute we say Deere interferes with its own contract,
Illinois allows joinder.
Out.
No, look, Illinois allows joinder. The question is, could you sue in Illinois saying these managers are wicked rogues and in the same suit allege Deere committed racial discrimination?
Certainly. I agree
and
we
the
could.
The answer is yes. Illinois allows that kind of joinder.
Yes.
So your problem is that the doctrine of merger and bar, which is part of res judicata, says that claims that you could have brought but don't, but arising out of the same transaction, are barred.
Only
that's your problem.
Well, only if the parties are mandatory parties. And Deere was not a party. Deere had no interest in the first case. And that has to be the position that we go with, because Deere could never have been responsible for anything that was in the first suit. And we had to plead that and we had to prove it. We lost. I agree with you, we lost. But the fact that we lost does not transfer that case to have been Deere as a party in interest. They were not there. They had no role in it. And had we won, we could have, as in DeFlon case from New Mexico, we could have sued, I'm sorry, if it's the other way around. If we sued Deere first in DeFlon, we could have then come back and sued these other based upon the result. The key focus here is that to go with the way that the trial judge did in this case and the way the defendants are arguing, you have to look at the result of the first case, not what the pleadings are in the first case. And it's our position that for purposes of res judicata, that deciding factor has to be the pleadings, what was being pled in the first case for the identity of the cause of action. Now, switching over, I've touched on the basis of the identity of the action. I'm not going to push that one. Our argument is what it is. What I think really has to happen here is that we believe, because of the identity of parties, this should be reversed as a matter of law. The case should go back to the court with an order for a stay. The 1981 action is now preserved in the state court proceeding, and that would be decided under the Hicks decision on appeal in that case when res judicata is supposed to be based upon Illinois law. Then, when that's decided, the court could dismiss this underlying case. The problem is, if this case doesn't get dismissed or doesn't get kicked back and stayed, the Illinois appellate courts never have a chance to straighten out what's happened and weigh in on Illinois law on the case, because this case would become res judicata and stop us from arguing those issues in the pending Illinois case. That's all I have for now. I reserve the rest for the rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors.
I'm confused. What's the status of the second state court action?
Your Honor, that case has proceeded through a bench trial. Summary judgment occurred before that. One claim unrelated to the termination proceeded to a bench trial. And we're in post-trial briefing at this stage, Your Honor. But all of the issues related to the termination have been disposed of either on a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment, and twice disposed of, actually, because Mr. Harrison filed a motion for reconsideration. And as I would point out, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, Judge Lefstein has already held that there's privity of parties here, not just once, but twice, rejecting the same arguments that have been presented today. I never got to say, may it please the court, but Your Honors,
may it please
the court. That's quite all right. We think Judge Darrow put it exactly right when she said that this case is a model for why courts employ res judicata to preclude duplicative and wasteful litigation. As we've already pointed out in Mr. Doak's argument, this is the third in a series of lawsuits Mr. Harrison has brought, all of them based on the exact same facts underlying his termination. I understand that they're primary argument today is the privity of parties element, and so I will focus on that argument as well. But I would point out that in their briefing to this court, they identified as their primary argument the identity of causes of action element. We won't belabor that point, and we'll rely on our briefs because we think there's no question that all of these claims arise out of the same cause of action. As far as the privity analysis, the rule in Illinois law, under Illinois law, is that the bar of res judicata applies equally not only to the actual parties in the original action, but also anyone whose interests were adequately represented in the original action. Based on this rule, a number of Illinois courts have held that employers and employees are in privity with each other for purposes of res judicata. Now, Mr. Doakes has stated that Deere had no interest in the Addington litigation. We would beg to differ with that, Your Honor. These individual defendants in Addington, their sole basis for defense is that they're acting within the scope of their employment at all times. They're responding to allegations that a senior manager had sexually assaulted a coworker and was sexually harassing another coworker. Deere had an absolute obligation under the law to investigate those allegations, and Deere can't itself, as a corporate entity, do that. It needs its employees to do that, and these employees did exactly that and defended successfully on that basis. Now, Mr. Doakes has pointed out that Deere couldn't have been held liable for intentional interference with contract. That's true. Deere can't be held liable because a corporate entity can't interfere with itself. That exact same rule applies to its employees so long as they're acting within the scope of their employment. In effect, it's the same rule extended to employees when it's established that they've acted within the scope of their employment. And the Illinois Appellate Court in Addington held quite clearly that all of the employees acted well within the scope of their employment and pointed out that Deere could have been liable for their actions. We think that there isn't any question then, based on the Illinois Appellate Court's reasoning, based on Judge Lefstein's repeated decisions in the second state court action Mr. Harrison filed, and based on the fact that certainly employees acting on behalf of their employer, indeed acting as Deere in an investigation and in defending themselves based on that investigation, share the same interests as Deere. And although Deere couldn't have been held liable for intentional interference with employment, they certainly could have been held liable for defamation. Mr. Doakes is incorrect in suggesting that they couldn't have. In fact, we've cited a case in our brief, the Vickers versus Abbott Laboratories decision, in which both the supervisors who carried out a sexual harassment investigation and the employer were sued. In addition, Deere, of course, had an interest in the Addington litigation because supposing one of the Addington defendants were held liable for intentional interference with employment, that would certainly make Deere's hands full in a subsequent action for a sort of cat's paw theory of liability under Section 1981 or Title VII, for that matter. At the end of the day, there isn't any question that this is the third time around for Mr. Harrison. He could have brought his Section 1981 claim, indeed should have brought his Section 1981 claim in his first state court action. He chose not to do that. Instead, he chose to split his claims. Now, whether he did that to benefit from being able to select his forum that he wanted to sue in, or to benefit by increasing litigation costs, or for some other reason, it's unclear. But what is clear is that the doctrine of res judicata is designed specifically to preclude these kind of litigation tactics. So we would ask that you affirm the district court's decision below. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Doak?
Thank you, counsel. Your honors. Just briefly, in terms of the argument, I wanted to focus on the Ross advertising case cited by the defendant appellees on page 7 of their brief. And they quoted that case for Illinois courts repeatedly holding that when employees are sued for actions taken within the scope of their employment, they are in privity with their employers for purposes of res judicata. And I don't think there's anyone here who's going to disagree with that proposition. That's true. When they're sued within the scope of their employment, they're in privity. Our claim is, when you look at the pleadings and focus on the proof requirements and the pleadings, that's what the suit is about. That's what determines whether they're in privity. not the end result when a judge finds against what we pled, but what were our pleadings. And that's an issue that hasn't been discussed in any of these cases. I couldn't find one that said, where do you focus? Do you focus on what the plaintiff's pleading is? Do you focus on what the proof the plaintiff had was? Or do you focus on the end result? Our position is you must focus on the plaintiff's pleading and the proof requirements, and if you do that, they're managers, but they're acting outside the scope. There's no privity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.